Our final presentation of the morning is entitled Top 10 RBC Morphology Changes in Classifying Anemia. Thank you.
And if you look in the proceedings book, you'll find that there is nothing there. Right. And I apologize for that. I don't know how I messed that up. But if you're interested in getting some notes, I'm not sure how I'll do this, either by hard copy or by a CD, but go by the IDEX booth, and they have no idea that you're going to come, but go by the booth, so that'll already be just alarming to them to begin with, but go by the booth, have your card swiped, and say you want notes from DeNicola, and we'll send you out a set. So it may either be a CD or hard copy, probably a CD, which will work better because then you'll have color pictures too. So let's go. We just talked about hematology and how exciting of an area it is for us in veterinary medicine right now. And I emphasized in the last talk that we're doing an extremely poor job, we as a global veterinary society, in looking at blood films. And in the vast majority of cases, it's dismal as far as not looking at blood films at all. I was at over the first 2 years while I was with IDEX, I was at Purdue University for 28 years and as an instructor there, and then I've only been with IDEX now for a little over 4 years as an educator for them. But in the first couple of years, they sent me everywhere to speak, and I don't know, I probably spoke to thousands of technicians and thousands of veterinarians in that first couple of years, and I asked the same question each time: how many people look at the blood films? And I did that deliberately because IDEX actually had some data that they had generated 10 years previously that said out of all practices doing any kind of in-house hematology, that the best they could see is somewhere between a 5 and 10% of the practices doing in-house hematology looked at blood films. And I said, well, that's not possible. But it is. That's exactly, you know, people would raise their hands and admit to the fact that they don't look at them. And there's a huge, huge amount of information being lost there. We just talked about validating the hematology data with that blood film and how quickly you can do that. And I'm going to focus now on red cell morphology to remind you of some of the things that we're going to be looking for to give us a little more information than just saying it's anemic or that it's a regenerative anemia, but what caused that anemia. And many of our hemolytic anemias do have good morphologic features that are very, very helpful, if not absolutely diagnostic for the cause. During that first couple of years, I also discovered that I was killing the poor people with lectures and pictures and EM pictures, and clearly nobody was retaining anything I had to say. It was kind of like veterinary school again. The students weren't listening either there. But I sat down with a group of technicians, and we developed kind of a Dave Letterman approach to hematology. And we set up a top 10 list for red cells, a top 10 list for white cells, and a top 2 list for platelets. There's not too much there we can do. And we chose a group of morphologic findings that are important from the perspective of maybe giving the veterinarian direction in further diagnostics, or because it's a common morphologic abnormality and we need to understand the underlying mechanism of its formation, or it may give us a specific diagnosis in some cases and limit our differential down to two or three things possible. So we tried to find those powerful type things, but limited to 10. And then I went to the group of clinical pathologists within IDEX, and they chewed me up and spit me out, and they finally admitted, oh, I guess you're right. We do need to kind of limit that whole intention. So we're going to go through the top 10 list here. And it's all based on the fact of understanding what normal morphology is. And you have to have respect for the red blood cell. You know, here's this relatively inert cell that's a partially filled bag of hemoglobin. But that cell lives for 80 to 120 days, depending on the species and circulation. And it's constantly being tested in both mechanically and having to go through 3 micron pores, half to the third the size of the red blood cell's diameter. So it has to be extremely deformable to get through there. It's constantly being challenged by hypoxia and hypoglycemia in the spleen, acidemia in the spleen, acidotic situations. So the cell is being tested constantly. And it's a dramatic cell as far as its survivability. The biconcave shape to the cell, looking at this three-dimensional scanning EM picture, gives you hopefully the respect that with that shape, I can now squeeze through a little pore, shifting the hemoglobin in different areas, and I can make my way through and continue in the system and constantly recirculate through that process. Once you change that shape, you alter the lifespan of that cell. So red cell morphology changes primarily give us insight into hemolytic disease. Hemolysis in the broadest sense is decreased lifespan of the red cell. And again, biconcave discoid shape is the key there. So keep that kind of shape in the back of your head, up in the kind of the top right of your head, brain, so that you can constantly remind yourself of that. Well, let's start with the list. And I said it included both common and important features. I put polychromasia at the very top because of how valuable it is in predicting or characterizing our anemic patients based on the first question the veterinarian should ask. If I have an anemia, the first question they should ask is it regenerative or non-regenerative? Because that immediately puts it into two different paradigms of diagnostic testing. So that's the first question I want to answer. And the most powerful morphology to do that is polychromasia. The presence of polychromatophils in circulation is our indication of a regenerative or a bone marrow responsive picture. So if we're here, anemia, regenerative versus non-regenerative, that's what I want to do. I am not going to replace the reticulocyte count with the polychromatophil count or just a subjective measure of the degree of polychromasia in the blood film, because the reticulocyte count is clearly the most objective measure that we have for characterizing regeneration versus non-regeneration. And I can use that to follow the patient very nicely. So I'm going to still use that reticulocyte count. But polychromasia correlates very, very well with the reticulocyte count. All polychromatophils, things that you can recognize as a polychromatophil, will be a reticulocyte if you do a special stain for reticulocytes. Not all reticulocytes are polychromatophils, though. I'll try to explain that in a second here. The blueness, well, let me show you the cell first. The polychromatophil is identified as these pale blue cells, typically larger than a normal red blood cell. And this is probably the best example of a normal red blood cell there. And when you look at the cells that are polychromatophils, they're pale blue and bigger. The blueness to the cytoplasm indicates that there's some RNA in the cytoplasm. A normal mature red blood cell doesn't have much RNA or has no RNA, no cytoplasmic organelles, because remember, it's not producing any new proteins. It's not producing any more hemoglobin. It's a partially filled bag of hemoglobin. And the enzymes that it has in there to protect oxidative changes to the membrane and the hemoglobin are what it has when it leaves the marrow at a mature state. If there is very, very small amounts of RNA in the cytoplasm, we probably cannot perceive that by looking at the light microscope with our regular stains. But if we do the new methylene blue preparation, which precipitates that RNA, we will be able to recognize that cell as a reticulocyte. So everything that is a polychromatophil will be a reticulocyte, but not all reticulocytes are identified as polychromatophils. And again, it's a good morphologic evidence of bone marrow response. And I worded it that way, not to say that it's a regenerative anemia, because we do see bone marrow responses in non-anemic animals. Think of that animal that has moved, like my dog did when I spent 1 year in Albuquerque after being in Indiana for a long time, where I think we're at 350 feet above sea level in Indiana, and that's if you stand on top of the corn. And then you go to Albuquerque. I was concerned about my Newfoundland because her normal hematocrit in Indiana was 55, which is pretty high for a Newfoundland. And during that first month I was in Albuquerque, I did her blood work every week, and then I stopped after it hit 65 because I didn't want to see how high it was going to go. It's always, you put the blinders on, it'll be okay. If she kind of collapses, then I'll probably know there's a problem. Made a little sluggish flow, but in that first week of time, even though her hematocrit's going up, there's a lot of polychromasia evident. There was a demand because she was in a hypoxic situation. If there's cardiovascular disease, respiratory disease, that's going to cause an erythrocytosis. Glucocorticoids or Cushing's, you'll see a low-grade reticulocytosis because those patients, there's a bone marrow response even without an anemia. There are other things we can see with regeneration. I'm not going to go through the details of all of them. Anisocytosis, target cell formation, Howell Jolly body presence, basophilic stippling, nucleated red blood cells. All of those things can be seen with a regenerative picture, but the only one that's consistently important is polychromasia. With every other morphologic change that's listed in there, you can see that change without there being a regenerative picture. So we can't rely on nucleated rads. We can't rely on target cell presence as a predictor of regeneration or bone marrow response. We have to rely on polychromasia. So it's really quite critical for us to be able to identify those and recognize them pretty quickly. The luxury we have is that there are very few polychromatophils in circulation in the dog and the cat normally. So when they're there, they're really obvious. The one problem I see in some practices is the fact that they're probably not the best they could be with their DiffQuick staining. And if all the red blood cells look blue, you're probably not going to be able to recognize a polychromatophil. So you have to do a little practicing on your staining to get the red cells to look red-orange. Number two on the top 10 list, spherocytes. Everybody knows what spherocytes are for, right? What are they associated with? Hemolytic immune-mediated hemolytic anemia. It's a very specific type of hemolytic anemia, but we see them in other disease processes as well. When we see them as the primary morphology change, and these are the spherocytes, all of these more densely staining cells that appear smaller than the normal red blood cells, And here I'll point to a normal red blood cell to compare to. But the spherocytes are smaller appearing, more dense, and have no central pallor. If that's the only morphology, significant morphology that I find on the blood film, that is hugely helpful in looking for an extravascular immune-mediated hemolytic process. And I'll explain why that's happening in a second. But if I see other types of poikilocytosis or abnormalities in shape, I am cautious in interpreting spherocytes because there are different ways to get them formed. If there's a lot of spiculated cells like acanthocytes, if there are Heinz bodies, if there is schistocytosis or fragmentation, each of those processes can also lead to the presence of spherocytes. So if I see another morphology change, I'm very, very careful in how I interpret it. But this field, this is very, very diagnostic and very, very supportive of an immune-mediated hemolytic process. What happens? Something affects the cell that for some reason the cell is recognized as being foreign. It's not a normal red blood cell. It doesn't belong in that host anymore. And there's an immune response to it. So there are antibodies that are collecting on the surface of the cells because of some sort of abnormality recognized by these yellow triangles on the red cell surface. I'm quite the artist, aren't I? It could be an infectious agent that's in the cell or on the cell, like mycoplasma. It could be a drug effect that's been incorporated in the membrane. We rarely identify the underlying cause, but we're going to look for some of those things. So if there was a history of drugs, I'm going to probably try to change the drug. If I can recognize things like babesia or mycoplasma, obviously I'm going to treat that before just treating it like an immune-mediated hemolytic anemia by itself. But there's something abnormal there, and antibodies are directed against it, and that's what these little Ys are. And now the fixed macrophages in the spleen, the liver, the lymph nodes, the bone marrow, they have receptors for these antibodies, and they're going to try to attach to that antibody and try to phagocytose that cell. You have to understand there are hundreds and thousands of these antibodies on the surface of a red blood cell with an immune-mediated hemolytic process. But because the cells are in a fluid environment, the macrophage doesn't have the opportunity. It's a relatively slow phagocytic cell. It doesn't have the opportunity to phagocytose the whole cell. And what it ends up doing is taking a little bite of the cell. And it takes a small piece of membrane, and the red blood cell reseals. Happens over and over and over and over again. And think about the normal discocyte. It was a partially filled bag of hemoglobin. If I keep taking away some of the membrane, it's like tying off part of that balloon and pushing all the water that I put in that water, partially filled water balloon, and I'm going to shove it over to one side, I'm going to end up with a cell that looks like this. A spherical cell. Notice how clever hematologists are. A spherocyte is spherical. Well, they could have called it Bob, but no, it's a spherocyte. But you can immediately recognize that this cell has no deformability. It has to have a very, very short lifespan in circulation. It's nowhere near that normal discoid-shaped cell that you kept up in the top right part of your brain. So sphericides are kind of important. How do they present? Here's a moderate magnification of one where there are plenty of sphericites in there, smaller than normal, loss of central pallor, more dense appearing cells than the normal red blood cells. There's also another common feature. Many of these, or most of these that you see, will eventually be responsive. Bone marrow will give a good response. So there's plenty of polychromasia in here. And along with that, a lot of anisocytosis as well. Remember, you are the primary people seeing these cases. And also remember that if you had that little poodle that was normal one day, and that evening before they brought him into you, she collapsed and was very lethargic and had a point-in-time hemolytic crisis, when you see that dog in the morning, it's not going to be responsive anemia. It's just going to have a lot of spherocytes, maybe, if it's an immune-mediated hemolytic anemia. Remember, there's a lag time before the bone marrow can respond, and we won't see a good reticulocyte response for at least 48 to 72 hours after the hemolytic crisis. So don't ignore it as being an immune-mediated disease if you do not see polychromasia. Just give it a little time. It'll get there. Hopefully. Agglutination is also something we see. It's reported a lot more than we actually see it. It's kind of like when I was a resident in training, I diagnosed a lot of mesotheliomas with thoracic fluid evaluations. I didn't see many, but I diagnosed a lot of them. We do that in veterinary medicine a lot. There's a lot of diagnosis of autoagglutination, but we don't see it as much as is really out there. But when things clump up, beyond rouleau, those three-dimensional clumps that could be grossly seen or microscopically seen here, that's a tight bond between those cells associated with that antibody on the surface of the cells and cross-linking of antibodies from one cell to another. So when we see good agglutination, that's also dramatic support for an immune-mediated mechanism. What you have to do, this is pretty blatant, even this microscopic field of view is pretty blatant agglutination. The problem is that agglutination or marked rouleau can look like agglutination, and it's often misinterpreted as agglutination. If you can remind yourself of what rouleau is that very weak bond on the surface of the cells related to different charges, surface charges on one red cell compared to the other red cell. Remember playing with magnets on the table as a kid, like I did last night. You know, the North Pole can push the North Pole away because like charges repel one another, and then the magnet will flip around and cleck. The dissimilar charges attract one another. But it's a very weak bond compared to that cross-linking of antibodies. So we can take that little bit of knowledge and help differentiate the two if there's any suspect. And in the reference labs, that's exactly what our technicians do. If they see something that is suspicious of agglutination, they immediately have to do what we call a wet saline agglutination test. It's a very, very simple test can be done in practice. All you need is some normal saline, physiologic normal saline, and there are a lot of different ways the books and literature says to do them. What I like to do is take a drop of EDTA anticoagulated blood, put it on a glass slide, put a cover slip on top of it, and then put a little pool of that normal, physiologic normal saline right at the edge of the cover slip on the glass slide, and watch microscopically as the saline comes under the cover slip and mixes with the clump cells and starts diluting them. With the dilution process, most of the rouleau, if not all of the rouleau, will dissipate. It'll disappear. But the three-dimensional clumping associated with the cross-linkings will remain. So what I do is I actually follow, remember, they're going to be moving around. It's really a good thing to do with a junior high student if they're visiting the practice. You can be like Mr. Wizard. You have them look in the microscope and they're moving around. And you can tell them that's really a blood vessel or something. I don't know. You make something up. You're a veterinarian. You can do that. You have my permission. But I follow one of those three-dimensional balls around. If it's rouleau, you'll see the cells just kind of drop off each other. But true agglutination stays there. So what I end up with is something like a 1 to 200 dilution or even greater, and I maximize the potential of that diluting effect. But you need to do that to validate. You can't just say it's agglutination based on looking at the blood film. This is what agglutination would look like on that wet prep. This is dramatic agglutination. I need to take some pictures of some microscopic or some small groups of agglutination because we do see it where they're down to 3, 5, 6 cells in a group. And although this is not seen in most of our immune-mediated hemolytic anemias, it's actually seen in very few, it is an important finding and observation to make because it affects how we interpret our lab data off our analyzer. If there is clumping going on, I do not trust my red cell count, even in the reference lab where we have $120,000 Advia cooking. Acanthocytes. These are neat cells because they've got an interesting history in their formation. They're pretty easy to recognize because they don't look anything like normal cells. They have a very defined, or it comes from human definition again. The definition is that it has anywhere from 2 to 10 blunt, finger-like projections of varying length off the surface of the cells. And it's important to stay it that way because many times people will misidentify it or misinterpret it as crenation. Crenation is shrinkage of a cell, probably because you didn't put enough blood in that EDTA tube and the cells are in a hyperosmolar situation and they're losing the water to that hyperosmolar situation. And when they shrink really quite uniformly and it results in short, sharp, uniform projections from the surface, distributed evenly on the cell. Acanthocytes, 2 to 10 blunt finger-like projections of varying lengths. Why did they get there? It goes back to physiology, I'm afraid. I'm sorry to say. you have to remember that the cell membrane on the red blood cell is in constant equilibrium with the lipids in the plasma. And if you upset that cholesterol to phospholipid ratio in the plasma, we start accumulating lipids onto the surface, on the outer leaflet of the red cell membrane. I think I have a cartoon to show that. Here's kind of a normal cell. Phospholipids are nicely arranged. And if something happens out here in the plasma facing the outer leaflet, and I alter that cholesterol to phospholipid ratio, I start adding lipid, like cholesterol, into the membrane. And although a cartoon, I think graphically you start recognizing, oh, that's probably where some of those projections are coming from. There's actually a couple of steps to the formation of acanthocytes, and I'll reserve that for a comment with one of the other top 10 items. But it's easy to see that as we add more lipid loading into those cells, we can start getting very irregularly shaped and non-uniform irregular shapes. I guess that's kind of redundant, isn't it? But non-uniform projections from the surface of those cells in there. What's the causes? Well, I always put liver disease at the top of my list because the liver plays a relatively significant role in lipid metabolism. So I've got that at the top of the list. Splenic disease is included in there because primarily information from human literature. In the human literature, it's really quite vague. It says that the spleen plays some unknown role in the final shape maturation of the red blood cell. And in human medicine, if you take a spleen out, say there's a trauma and they had to do a splenectomy, you will immediately start seeing acanthocytes in circulation in low numbers in the human. Now, I'm old enough to remember where all of our blood donors at the university were splenectomized because we were going to try to keep Hemobart from infecting our patients, and obviously that didn't work. But I saw a lot of blood films on dogs without spleens, and I never saw that acanthocytosis form. However, we do see occasionally splenic disease where we have acanthocytosis, pure splenic disease. Most of the time when we see splenic disease associated with something like hemangiosarcoma or malignant lymphoma, the liver is also involved in there, either because of compression or because of tumor invasion or metastatic disease, and the liver is usually part of that picture. So it's hard to say what caused the acanthocytosis, but there are well-documented cases where just the spleen is involved with disease, mostly neoplastic diseases, resulting in acanthocytes. And I think probably most of you, if I told you I had a 8-year-old German Shepherd with a big mass in the abdomen and in the area of the spleen, and I had a mild anemia with a lot of acanthocytes and some schistocytes, and it's in DIC, you probably all would have referred it to somebody quickly because it's a hemangiosarcoma case. I thought exactly that of my Newfoundland when she was almost 8 at the time, and she ended up having malignant lymphoma, the liver and the spleen. So it's not always diagnostic. No, cat's very different. The question was, is that true in the cat as well as the dog? And cats don't form acanthocytes really well. In fact, some people have bastardized the term for acanthocytes in cats because they only typically have one funny projection from the surface, not 2 to 10 blunt finger-like projections. But yeah, we don't see that. So I include spleen in there. Here's a case of a lymphoma case, disseminated disease. It does involve spleen, liver, every organ possible. There are a lot of things in here, but some nice acanthocytes, some schistocytes as well. This is a case of DIC, no platelets, getting schistocytes, acanthocytes. We see it in a variety of disease processes. The primary disease in this animal was hepatic failure with the DIC. Sometimes you're going to have a hard time differentiating, is it acanthocyte or is it a crenated cell? And probably the best thing to do is just go get another sample, don't use any anticoagulant, just make a blood film immediately, and that eliminates the EDTA artifact. But even there, it's going to be a little hard. A trick that I do is, and I've had to use it a lot more since I left the university, because at the university, I saw samples that were maybe 30 minutes old, and now at the in a reference lab, I'm seeing samples that are now 12, 24, 48 hours old, and they've been sitting in this EDTA soup for a long time, and almost every single blood film that comes through a pathologist review has tremendous crenation. It was devastating to me because I couldn't see any red cell morphology changes. But if you go way out to the feathered edge, and that's what this field is, notice there's no central pallor in any of the cells. Way out at the feathered edge is not where we do red cell morphology because the red cells flatten out completely, so we lose the biconcave disc shape. Crenation disappears out at the feathered edge. But if you can find a few cells that still have a little bit of a bleb on the surface, that's good support that there's true poikilocytosis in there. Next one, top 10. Target cell formation or leptocytosis. And this one actually is exactly the same as acanthocytes in development. It's, again, a cleverly named cell, the target cell. It's not a Kmart cell. It's a target cell because it looks like targets. Cells have prominent central pallor in there. And we see target cells really quite commonly. In essentially every case where you see polychromasia or a responsive picture, we see target cells because those young, immature cells don't have their full hemoglobin complement and they have excess membrane to volume ratios. So the cell has this kind of floppy surface membrane. And the best rheologic shape for the cell to take is this kind of mirror image Mexican hat morphology where that excess membrane is kept in the middle of the cell. So if there's a slight increase in lipid there, that's exactly what you're going to see. Now, if you do not see regeneration, you do not see a lot of polychromasia, and you pick up a lot of target cells, start thinking about underlying lipid metabolism abnormalities and think about liver disease. And I'll almost guarantee you that the next systemic, portosystemic shunt you see, so the next Yorkie that comes in your practice, look really closely at the blood film, and you'll find target cells in many of those patients. In a detailed review of a blood film for animals with liver disease or hepatic insufficiency, we find that kind of morphology very, very commonly. If there's a real high cholesterol, I'm not going to interpret it. If there's a lot of polychromasia, I'm not going to interpret it. But if I have a normal or low cholesterol level and I don't see any other changes that support responsiveness, I'm going to go look for liver disease. And, you know, I might even suggest doing a bile acid, even though my chemistry profile has no evidence of renal of liver disease. Target cells, lipid loading. Next one, hypochromasia. This is, for us in veterinary medicine, really quite important because we have such a short list of things that can cause it. In veterinary medicine, it primarily is associated with chronic blood loss. We don't see the thalassemias. We don't see some of the hemoglobinopathies in human medicine that we see in veterinary or in veterinary medicine that we see in human medicine. So when we see these cells in a hypochromic cell, you need to compare it to a normal cell. So I'm going to point to the best normal cell in this field, and that's this cell on the right center. That's close to a normal cell. And if you start looking at these other cells, they're pale compared to the normal cell. They have an accentuated central pallor. And in many cases, they're smaller than the normal cell. And to us, that means chronic iron deficiency. So if I have a young dog that has that, I'm going to look for fleas and I'm going to have internal blood-sucking parasites. If it's an older animal or a middle-aged animal, I'm going to go look at the bladder, see if I've got a transitional cell carcinoma that's bleeding slowly. I'm going to look at the GI tract, especially in the colon, to see if I've got a bleeding polyp or a bleeding low-grade or benign tumor there. Many of these tumors can have bleeding cases that can be going on for months and months and months, and eventually we can exhaust that iron stores, and we'll see these kind of changes. This is the pattern. If this is a dramatic disease process at this point, and this one should have both a low MCV, mean corpuscular volume, and a low MCHC, mean corpuscular hemoglobin concentration, because this is an advanced stage of that iron deficiency. During the early phases of a developing chronic blood loss, chronic iron deficiency case, don't forget that you're going to see a rather significant reticulocytosis. Because until we deplete the iron stores, the bone marrow is going to be as efficient as possible in trying to keep up with the peripheral demand for oxygen carrying capabilities. So we have potentially 200,000, 300,000 reticulocytes per microliter, but the morphology, the cells are getting smaller, the hemoglobin concentration is getting smaller, maybe not outside of the reference interval yet, but they're getting smaller and smaller. And when you look at the blood film, you will actually see, you'll actually see that the polychromatophil that's usually larger than a normal red blood cell is typically smaller than a normal red blood cell. And that's probably one of the earliest morphologic changes you'll see, way before you'll see MCV, MCHC changes. The blood film is clearly much, much more sensitive at picking up a developing blood loss iron deficiency. But it's a very important one because it tells us exactly what's going on. Schistocytes, again, gives us very important information. Identifying them is not as difficult. They're these irregular fragments in the peripheral blood. And if this is representative of the whole blood, this one has dramatic schistocytosis. I mentioned that, you know, in the last lecture that we're looking for morphology changes that are really quite obvious, that we see them even at low magnification, that there are multiple morphologic abnormalities in every field of view. Schistocytes is one of those morphology changes where finding very few in every, maybe one in every other field or every three fields is significant, because these cells are removed, or these fragments of cells are removed very quickly, so they don't last in circulation long at all. What it tells us? It tells us there's mechanical injury. Again, it gives the veterinarian direction. I'm going to look at heart disease, valvular disease. I'm going to look for potentially a heavy adult heartworm load with turbulent flow is going around the adult parasites causing fragmentation. I'm going to look for diseases like glomerulonephritis and in that glomerulus in the capillary beds. And I'm going to look at other microvascular, very small capillary bed tissues to try to identify it. Is it a vasculitis that's causing it? Or is this patient just in DIC? It's always so hard for us as veterinarians to really characterize a patient as DIC. We clinically say, boy, it looks like it's in DIC. And then if you're religious and you do the lab test, you find out, oh, geez, I don't have three of the four or four of the five tests to say that it is DIC. Most people forget to look at the blood film and try to look for schistocytes. That could be a nice little additional notch to put in that profile that you're trying to characterize. Is it truly in DIC? But mechanical injury is what we talk about. There's still a study set at Purdue that I use for years with a past student that was a marathon runner. I didn't know it at the time, but I was doing the red cell hematology lecture and saying, these are why I don't exercise. You know, I'm not going to run around and because I know every time I stomp, I'm going to break a red cell or two, and I'm going to cause schistocytosis. And I said, marathon runners, I don't understand those people at all. And she was really quite offended, which immediately gave me more ammunition. So I picked on her more. And I said, absolutely. I can guarantee you that you're breaking a lot of red cells every time you go out for these little 26-mile jogs. I still don't understand that. I'm sorry. But and if there are marathon runners, I apologize, but I don't understand it. There's that armchair thing that works fine for me. She was really quite defensive about the whole thing, and so I said, okay, I'll challenge you. Let's go out and we'll collect. This is when we could touch human blood. I said to the class, we'll meet Saturday morning out in front of the vet school, and there were actually about 25 or 30 students that showed up, which surprised me on a Saturday morning. And we collected her blood and said, now, do your little jog. Just make sure you come back here because we're not going to have to go someplace to find you. We went inside. We made some blood films, very normal blood. And then we went to the donut shop, came back a couple hours later, and she gets there and collected her blood. We're still using that study set at Purdue because every single 100X field of view has a schistocyte in it. I mean, the poor girl was devastated. And I commented, you're a well-trained athlete. You take an iron supplementation. This is a fragment of your red cell mass. Don't worry about it. But I guarantee it was going to happen because at the point of maybe the 24th mile, there's hypoxia, acidosis, hypoglycemia, and all those old cells, the ones that are going to get removed by the spleen anyways, if you put a little bit of mechanical trauma on them, they're going to break. It's the nature of the disease. We used to have the term March's hemoglobinemia in the military, where after a 20-mile full-pack march, they would come back, go into the men's room, and there's a lot of hemoglobin in there, mechanical injury. It affected how boots were designed, how the packs were designed. Mechanical injury is impressive. That's kind of what they look like three-dimensionally. So actually, I took these out of a book in a human medicine. They have it's called the Red Cell Zoo. He has all different kind of shaped cells that look like different animals. Really quite impressive. If you see a whole bunch of schistocytes in a row, and the leukocytes are broken too, that's probably a scratch. Don't overinterpret a scratch on the slide, because you can do that after you stain it. So don't make that mistake. Metarubicides. Oh, question, sorry. Animals predisposed to mechanical injury? Right? People have suggested, specifically the greyhound, have suggested that that's true, but if that's the case, boy, you would think we would see much more of it. I don't have the experience to say that one breed is more predisposed than another. If you look at red cell osmolality or osmotic fragility testing, they're really quite similar breed to breed to breed. So I would be surprised, but I've heard anecdotal comments like that before. So sorry. Metarubicides. Never met a rubicide I didn't like, right? This is a huge soapbox of mine, and remember it was one of the things that we could see with regenerative anemias. Another question I commonly asked in those first couple of years with IDEX was, what morphology, before I even started speaking about it, related, what morphology on the blood film would you choose as being the most predictive of regeneration? Nucleated red blood cells, metarubicides, would win all the time. Never use nucleated reds as an indicator of regeneration. Realize that you can see nucleated reds in a regenerative response, particularly a marked regenerative response, but don't use it as the definition. It's regenerative versus non-regenerative. When you see them in circulation, think of bone marrow stromal damage. Maybe there's a heavy metal toxicity like lead toxicity, marrow infiltrative disease, another neoplastic process going in there, septicemia with is endothelial damage to the bone marrow. But there's something affecting the hematopoietic tissue that normally prevents metarubicides from going into circulation. In normal hematopoiesis, the nucleus is removed in the hematopoietic tissue and the cell continues to mature, then it's released from the marrow. There's a physical and a physiologic barrier at the pores at the bone marrow stroma itself. And unless you damage that with any of these other processes, you're not going to get them into circulation. What happens in the strong regenerative anemias is that there actually is damage to that stroma because there's such an expansion of the erythroid compartment that you stretch open some of those pores. In addition, what do we see? Say in a really, really good regenerative anemia that's, say, an immune-mediated hemolytic anemia, we find splenomegaly. A big part of that splenomegaly is extramedullary hematopoiesis. We can see it in the spleen, liver, lymph nodes, lungs. We can see it in a lot of tissues. Those other tissues do not have the same stromal restrictions as the bone marrow. So they can allow some to get out. But in every case, if you see nucleated reds, you'll see plenty of polychromasia. And the polychromatophyll should be way outnumbering the nucleated reds. And then some of us use terms like, well, that's an appropriate nucleated red cell response. And I don't know if that's a good way to word it. It's never appropriate, but at least it's acceptable in a strong regenerative anemia. When we see it without any regeneration, maybe without an anemia, immediately you have to go look at the bone marrow and see what's going on there. And these can be tough to diagnose. You know, in case of an infiltrative disease process, a fine needle aspirate may be enough, but many of these may require actually core biopsies to look at the histologic structure of the marrow, things to look for myelofibrosis, things like that. Heinz bodies, we don't see a lot of Heinz body anemias, but there's one that gives us a very, very short list. Heinz bodies are these blunt, nose-like projections on the surface of the cells. They represent denatured, oxidized hemoglobin. And the way the red cell handles damaged hemoglobin in the cell, it collects it at the surface, inner leaflet of the red cell membrane, and then moves it along the membrane into one localized aggregate, which we'll end up seeing like this, and these little blebs of deoxidized, denatured hemoglobin, denatured oxidized hemoglobin, can be easily pulled out by the macrophages in the spleen as they go through. So it's a good way to remove that damaged hemoglobin. What do we think of? Onion toxicity, Tylenol toxicity in the cat, phenothiazines, red maple in the horse. But the list is really quite small. Finding it is important. There are a couple of other morphology changes, and there's what a three-dimensional look like. There's this physical or this rigid body sticking on top of the cell, and you can see how that might stop from going through a small pore someplace. You start seeing other things. You'll start seeing fragments. You'll see blister cells and keratocytes. These are where the Heinz body has been removed in many cases. So we'll see the blister cells with the membrane around it. Here's another schistocyte. Excuse me. Here's a keratocyte with an open up with the horns. And notice the Heinz bodies in the background and some of the other cells. We even can see eccentricytes. Again, a clever name by hematologists. This is where all the hemoglobin's pushed eccentrically. And what happens is that oxidized hemoglobin gets on that inner leaflet. If the two sides of the membrane touch, it fuses like a Velcro and pushes all the hemoglobin off to the side. So what you're going to see is something that might look like a spherocyte, and if you look very closely, you'll see the little tag of membrane, like this and this. And notice again, there are Heinz bodies in the background. So you may see several of these. Remember I said the Heinz bodies are removed pretty quickly. So if I see eccentricytes, keratocytes, blister cells, I'm going to start thinking about oxidant injury, even though it's not a classic form for oxidant injury. And the last one for the list, I just tripped myself, how did I do that, is a, like most lists that are shortened, you always have a garbage can. So I'm going to throw in there all the miscellaneous inclusions that we could see, whether it's infectious diseases, basophilic stippling, iron accumulation, that these are the things that when you see it, you maybe recognize that it's abnormal, and you immediately go to the atlas and you open it up and you look for the inclusion chapter and you try to match up the pictures. It's not rocket science. That's what pathologists do too. If it's something that doesn't immediately stimulate that right neuron to recognize what it was, they go back to that book and look to find comparisons to it. With our infectious diseases, realize that we've got an extremely mobile society. This Babesia gibsoni infection is something that we saw at Purdue University in Indiana. That's a disease that's restricted to the Gulf Coast. And we were told by the owner over and over again, the dog always lived in Indiana. And after about the third or fourth or fifth time drilling her, she finally got frustrated with us. So why do you keep asking that question? And the clinician explained, and I like the way they explain it, the clinical pathologists think it's Babesia gibsoni, which is only seen in the Gulf Coast states, because obviously they're not right. And then the owner comes up and says, oh, well, we vacation there 2 months out of the year, but we live in Indiana. Well, that's a really rapid journey through some morphology changes. It's clearly a very small part of the whole hematology and red cell morphology, but it does help you identify some of the things that are easy to recognize and have huge value in either directing you diagnostically or minimizing your diagnostic differential list. Question? Well, if you actually look at the reticulocyte production index, this is where you correct for hematocrit, then you do the maturation time, which has never been proven in dogs, anyways, and you come up with values that anything greater than 1 for an RPI supports regeneration or bone marrow response above normal. And things above 3 are strongly supportive of hemolytic disease. A mild hemolytic anemia could have less than 3, but blood loss anemias rarely are going to go over that 3, RPI of 3. I'm sorry, that? And they should be. And I was going to end that with, because there are no good numbers to do that, but several of the clinical pathology texts give you guidelines. The reference interval for a dog is less than 60,000, for a cat less than 50,000 per microliter. That would be considered among 120 clinically normal dogs and cats. And in reality, it's one of those that doesn't follow a nice Gaussian distribution, so it's really skewed to the low end. But things above 50,000 to 60,000 can be considered abnormal in the cat and dog respectively. But we really don't call it regenerative until it starts getting above 100 to 120,000 in the dog. And that's mild regeneration. And above 60,000 in the cat. And then you can define your own terms, but some of the immune-mediated hemolytic anemias in the dog, it's much more profound a response in the dog than the cat, always. But you'll see some of your immune-mediated hemolytic anemias or other types of hemolytic anemias that will have reticulocyte counts of 250, 300,000, 400,000 and higher. Okay. Any other questions? Well, thank you for bearing with me. Oh, sorry.